So I want you to take just a moment to think about a person or perhaps a few people that have just driven you batty. Okay, maybe this week, maybe this month. I'm only going to give you a minute, okay, just 60 seconds, because we could spend the rest of the morning on this, right? For some of you, it may be... For some of you, it may be your spouse has just that annoying habit which they've had for 25, 30 years, 40, just in some way showed itself in an exquisitely pointed fashion this week again. For some of you, it may be a child. For some of you, it may be a political figure. I don't know. For some of you, it may be... maybe your employer, but I want you to pause this moment, just a moment, to think about who you might identify this morning as your enemy. Who, when you look at this person, which people do you employ the dagger stare towards? Who in your heart this morning have you not forgiven? Who's causing you to take a couple of extra Zantac? Who causes your blood pressure to go above pre-hypertension to stage 1 or 2 hypertension? What people is that or are they? Because this is Jacob's issue, right? Jacob has offended several people, but he has offended one person more than any other. And we can imagine the hatred, the jealousy, the anger that boils up inside of Esau every time he thinks of Jacob. You remember their story, right? Their brotherly encounter where Esau has been out hunting apparently for quite some time, and Jacob has decided to do his cuisine cook thing, and he's over a fire. He's got a savory stew going. This thing is bubbling. It's full of meat and vegetables and savory sauces and broth. And it's been cooking for a long time, and the aroma of this pot of stew is just rising out of the pot, and it's filling the air, and it's going towards wherever Esau has been hunting, and he is famished. He is starving because apparently he hasn't done very well this trip. He hasn't eaten probably for several days, maybe, and he arrives at the point to where his brother is cooking the meal, and he is starving. And remember, he says, "Give me some of that stew." And his loving, tender, generous brother Jacob, without thinking twice, takes the largest bowl that he has and ladles it full of the best parts of this stew. And hands it to Esau with a smile and with the utter generosity that comes between brothers. Right? Is that the story? No, nothing could be further from the truth. Right? Esau arrives at the chef Jacob's restaurant starving and asks him for a bowl of stew. And Jacob says, "Boy, you look really hungry, Esau. Been a while since you've had a meal. Do you smell this? Take another whiff, Esau. Would you like some?" Esau goes and so Jacob says, "Okay." He ladles some into a bowl and says, "Here, you can have this, but first, you have to give me your birthright. You were born first, Esau. But I've always wanted what you have, and so if you want this little bowl of stew, if you want these, uh, this mutton and these carrots and the celery as it's drowned in this savory sauce. If you want this, then you've got to give me the right that all firstborn sons get from their fathers. You've got to give me the inheritance that would be yours so that I can have it, so that when Pop goes, I get everything that is Dad's, and you're second in line. You give me all of that, Esau, and you can have this measly bowl of soup. I love the way in which the King James used to headline this passage. We don't read the old King James very much anymore, but it's extremely valuable for some very poetic language. By the way, this coming summer, right, this coming year will be the 400th anniversary of the King James translation, right, 2011. So we're 400 years past the gift of the King James Bible to us. But I love the heading which the King James Bible gave to this little story between Esau and Jacob. It said, Esau sells his birthright for a mess of pottage. Sounds like he was from Texas, doesn't he? Right? That's a mess of cows there. That's a mess of pottage. So if anybody has the right to see daggers every time he looks at Jacob, it's Esau. If anybody has the right to be angry and boiling over with fury, it's Esau. Of course, he's responsible too, but we can understand the amount of anger, jealousy that must arise within Esau's heart every time he thinks of Jacob. And that's exactly what Jacob has been thinking about, because he's heard that Esau is coming to greet him with a group of apparently trained, strong men who help him with his animals, but who are also armed for battle. And so remember what Jacob does, knowing that Esau is coming toward him, because the first thought that enters Esau's or Jacob's mind is, Esau's coming to kill me. Esau is coming to chop my head off, to put it on top of a lance, and to ride around the country showing that he's finally gotten over his little brother. That's what Jacob's thinking. So remember what Jacob does. He sends two groups of animals and servants ahead of the group with which he's riding, so that the first group gets to Esau well before the second group does. And the first group is to tell Esau that that we're essentially for you. We're a gift to you from your brother Jacob. Now, of course, the first group didn't know how Esau was going to respond. For all they knew, Esau could have hacked them to bits and pieces in his fury and anger too. And so Jacob put their lives on the line in order to preserve his own life. But that's what we've come to expect from our friend Jacob. And then the second group follows behind that group, so that there is there's a double whammy coming. Jacob is to be softened by two buffers. The first group, wow, this wonderful gift my brother has given me. The second group, wow, this wonderful gift that my brother has given me. So by the time that Jacob finally gets there with his group, Esau has been buffered. He's settled down. He's become warm towards his brother rather than cold. He's not as hateful. He's not as angry. He's not as furious. And so Jacob has established all this in his scheming in order to try to put out the fire that he started all these years ago back in the land of his father. Well, after that takes place, we know that that finally Esau and Jacob have a meeting. Will you come with me to Genesis once more? And this time, we are in Genesis chapter 32. Pardon me, 33. And in Genesis 33, we get the story of what happens when Esau and Jacob actually come within the area of each other. Genesis 33, then, in verse 1. Jacob looked up, and there was Esau coming with his 400 men. He probably passed out at this point, but the text doesn't tell us that. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants. He put the maidservants and their children in front. Yeah, that's where that line of gentlemanly treatment first was introduced, where you always put the women and children in the lifeboat first, right? Jacob is the guy who started all that. No, Jacob is the guy who sends his wives, his maidservants, and his children in front of him just in case Esau and his 400 men are angry. What kind of guy is this? Particularly since just last week we saw that he had wrestled with God and had apparently had a conversion of his heart. But now the first thing that we see at the beginning of Genesis 33 is Jacob's back to his old tricks. He wants to send the women and the children ahead of him just in case his brother's still angry. He himself went on ahead and bowed down to the ground 7 times as he approached his brother. But Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Do you see the first word of verse 4 there? But. It's the great contrastive word which says, you know, you were expecting this, but we switched the entire story on you. This is going to happen instead of what you were expecting. Jacob and the readers of the text were expecting Esau to come in with his swords and his 400 soldiers and to whack down the men and the children and then get to Jacob just as soon as they could and plunge their swords into his breast and then stand over his dead body gloating. That's what Jacob was expecting, and that's what the text has kind of led us to expect too, because that's what Jacob has been expecting. But then comes this wonderful, unexpected, surprising, oh my gosh, word that changes the entire tenor, feeling, emotion of the text. Have you ever experienced a moment like that? You and your spouse have just had a fight. He or she was the one who offended you. And you're expecting the fight to last all evening. You're expecting the fight to last all day. You don't know if you'll be talking by the time dinner comes around or not. You've said something to your child, or your child has done something to you, and you're expecting the silent treatment for you don't know how long. You've had a friendship that has been 20, 30, 40 years old. And you did something, or he or she did something to offend you, and you think that you'll never get back together again. You think that you're separated forever. You've curled up in your bed in the fetal position. You're rocking back and forth, moaning. You don't have any taste. You're not hungry. All you want to do is sit and moan in your grief and your sadness because you think your life is over. All the sun has gone out, all the joy has disappeared, the rain's not falling, there's no green in your world, there's only brown, there's no blue sky, it's only cloudy. And then all of a sudden, the unexpected happens. The one who offended you comes to you out of nowhere with softness and gentleness, with unexpected brotherly love and tenderness, takes your hand, pats you on the shoulder, sits down next to you, and tells you how deeply sorry they are that they treated you that way. Or the one that you offended before you've even had a chance to have your heart softened to beg their forgiveness comes to you out of the blue and sits down next to you, puts their arm around you, pats your hand, and says, you know what? I forgive you. Have you ever had a moment like that? Because that's the moment that Jacob just experienced. His entire life has changed. His cloudy skies have changed to blue. It's raining again. Green begins to appear. In that dried old riverbed, water begins to flow. And his entire life has taken a turn. All because the offended one, all because the one who had his birthright taken, all because the one who never received love and gentleness from his brother, but only conniving jealousy and lust for more, had harmed him and had hurt him all those years ago. Take a look at that word again. It's the first word of verse 4. But. But Esau ran to meet Jacob. Didn't walk. He didn't sashay. He didn't do the two-step. He didn't waltz and he didn't tango. He ran. I'm just curious, how do you greet the people who have offended you? Do you even approach them? Do you keep your distance? When they appear around the corner, do you slip into a doorway? What is your foot language towards those who have offended and torn your heart apart? Esau ran. You know, one thing that tickles Pamela and I, we offend our dog Gracie I don't know how many times. And we did it again this morning. We had to leave her behind, and I know exactly what she's thinking. She's either thinking two things. You guys are so dumb you can't count to three. You guys are so mathematically challenged you don't realize that there are three of us who are to go every time we leave this house. Or she's thinking, you all are so mean, thoughtless, and cruel that you would leave me here alone, and I don't know how long you're going to be gone this time. But you know what? Every time we come in the garage door, what does Gracie do? She runs. She runs to us. No matter how long we've been gone, no matter how mathematically challenged or thoughtless we were, Gracie runs to greet us. What's your foot language towards those who have left you alone, not knowing whether they'll ever come back to you? To those who have left you alone, wondering whether you'll ever be fed or watered again? To those who have left you alone, wondering if you'll ever be able to tinkle on the grass again? I want you to think about that. What's your foot language toward them? Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. He didn't run up to him and knock him down, which was exactly what he deserved. Jacob could have used a father who took him out behind the woodshed a whole lot more than he did. But Esau ran up to him and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and kissed him. That's the language of lovers who have been apart, right? This is the language of airports and train stations, where he or she comes back from a business trip, he or she comes back from a vacation that the other one wasn't able to go on, and he or she steps off the train or off of the plane, and the two lovers run into each other's arms, throwing their arms around each other and kissing each other. This is the language of romance. This is the language of a heart that has been torn because the other person hasn't been around. And yet it's the offended one, it's the cheated one who is doing this. And they wept. Jacob's probably weeping just out of pure gratitude that his head's still attached to his torso. Then Esau looked up and saw the women and children that, remember, Jacob had sent in front to take the first blow. Esau looked up and saw the women and children. "Who are these with you?" he asked. One commentator I read this week said that this was small talk. This isn't small talk. This is a brother who is meeting his sisters-in-law and his nephews and nieces for the first time. "Who are these? Are these my nephews? Are these my nieces?" He can't wait to be introduced to them. Jacob answered, "They are the children God has graciously given your servant." Notice the language here. This is cop just pulled me over language. Right? All of a sudden, they're not cops anymore. They're not the law. They're sir and ma'am and officer. Pamela and I occasionally watch cops. It's amazing to watch how language changes when the crook is in the perimeter or the universe of a police officer. All of a sudden, it's an entirely different vocabulary. And now, of course, Jacob is not Esau's brother who stole his birthright. It's not Esau's brother who schemed his way into getting his blessing, which he deserved from his father. It's not Jacob the snake. It's Jacob, your servant. Oh, how quickly things change. Then the maidservants and their children approached and bowed down. Next, Leah and her children came and bowed down. Last of all came Joseph and Rachel, and they too bowed down. Esau asked, "What do you mean by all these droves I met? To find favors in your eyes, my lord." Not bro. Not east. But my lord. Oh, Jacob's smooth, isn't he? He is so smooth. This guy has been tested in the fire of manipulation and has passed with flying colors. "I'm your servant, you're my lord." Remember that in the line, the feeding chain, Jacob is now on top. Who's got the birthright? Jacob. Who got daddy's blessing? Jacob. Who should be calling who lord? Esau should be referring to Jacob as lord. But you see, Jacob's milking the situation for all it's possibly worth. But Esau said, verse 9, "I already have plenty, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself." That's the first time I think we've ever heard that language from a descendant of Isaac. Jacob has spent his whole life never being satisfied with what he had. He was second in line. He had to cheat his way into his birthright, cheated his way into daddy's blessing. He's never been satisfied with what he'd had. He's always been scheming, and his wife's followed in the same pattern. Here we find a descendant of Isaac, Esau, the one who had been offended, the one who had his birthright stolen, the one who had his blessing copped out from under him. We find the one who has been cheated saying, "I have plenty. Keep what you have for yourself." And notice his language is honest here. Did you hear his language? "I already have plenty, my brother." See, that's the way brothers talk to each other. East and Jake, right? "East, come on over here. Jake, let's go out and play some ball. Hey, brother, come on. This is my brother, East. It's my brother Jake. You see, Esau's talking square and fair. None of this lord and servant stuff. See, Esau, the offended one, is now the one who is modeling contentment in life for the snake. By the way, remember, the snake is the one that God elected. God himself said that Jacob's going to be the one I'm choosing, and Esau's going to be the one I'm going to push into the back. Notice that Jacob is the elected one here, but the elected one is being given a lesson by the one who has been pushed back into second place by God. It's often the case that the believer will sometimes be taught his or her best behavioral language by the unbeliever. Sometimes believers will be treated better by the unbeliever than they'll be treated by each other. And here, the elected one is being treated in a way which is proper by the one who is unelect. "No, please," said Jacob, verse 10. "If I have found favor in your eyes, accept this gift from me. For to see your face is like seeing the face of God. Now that you have received me favorably." Where have we seen this language about Jacob seeing the face of God before? We just saw it in the previous chapter. Right, he had seen God, and he had seen the face of God as he struggled and as he wrestled. And now notice, Jacob is willing to say this wonderful poetic phrase, "Esau, by looking into your face, I feel as though I've seen the face of God because you've received me." But notice, Jacob had to be received before he would receive. Jacob had to be tenderly treated by his offended brother before he could utter a sentence like, "When I look into your eyes, I feel as though I'm seeing the eyes of God. When I see your face, I feel as though I'm seeing the face of God." Jacob has had a conversion, as it were. He sees his brother differently now. He is more emotionally warm towards his brother, more accepting of his brother, able to be more generous towards his brother, but he had to be coddled in order to get there. Esau, the offended one, was there before the coddling. Which one are you? Are you the offended who cannot be generous towards the one who offended until the one who offended you coddles you? Or as the offended one who is indwelt by the Spirit and who is commanded to relate a particular way to their enemies, are you able to be warm and concerned for your enemies before your enemy coddles you? Jacob couldn't. But now Jacob is feeling relief. He's feeling acceptance. He believes that things have changed in the relationship. And so when all of that floods into his soul, he utters a wonderful, wonderful phrase. "When I look at your face, Esau, I feel as though I've seen the face of God." You see, that's where the brothers should have been all along. Do you feel that way when you look into the face of your enemy? That person that I asked you to think about when we first began our lesson this morning, when you look at their face, who do you see? What do you see when you look into the face of the person who causes your insides to be all tangled up, who sends your blood pressure soaring, who turns your face red, causes you to grit your teeth? What do you see when you look into that person's face? Please accept verse 11. the present that was brought to you, for God has been gracious to me, and I have all I need. Beam me up, Scotty. Because here is the snake. Here's the thief. Here's the cheat. Now declaring that he has all he needs. He's content. Maybe for the first time in his life, he's content. He spent his whole life trying to get things that God had decided not to give him. But now he declares his contentment along with the contentment of Esau. And because Jacob insisted, Esau accepted it. Then Esau said, "Let us be on our way. I'll accompany you." But Jacob said to him, "My lord knows that the children are tender and that I must care for the ewes and the cows that are nursing their young. If they are driven hard just one day, all the animals will die. So let my lord go on ahead of his servant while I move along slowly at the pace of the droves before me and that of the children until I come to my lord in Seir." Esau said, "Then let me leave some of my men with you." "But why do that?" Jacob asked. "Just let me find favor in the eyes of my lord." So Jacob is close to Esau. Jacob's grateful that things have turned out the way they are. But notice, he's not comfortable yet. "Y'all go on ahead. Don't leave anybody back with us. Y'all go on ahead and we'll meet you eventually at Seir." So that day, verse 16, Esau started on his way back to Seir. Jacob, however, went to Succoth. Did you catch that magic word which we saw up in verse 4? Notice the first word of verse 17. It may appear as the second word in some of your English translations, but in the Hebrew text it'll be the first word. It's again the word "but." It may be translated in your text as "however." Notice, Jacob, however, although he had told Esau that he was going to meet him at Mount Seir, Jacob, however, in contrast to what he had said, in difference to what he had said, went to Succoth, where he built a place for himself and made shelters for his livestock. That is why the place is called Succoth. After Jacob came from Padan Aram, he arrived safely at the city of Shechem in Canaan, and camped within sight of the city. For 100 pieces of silver he bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, the plot of ground where he pitched his tent. There he set up an altar and called it El Elohe Israel. So he told his brother he was going to meet him at Seir, but he goes to Succoth and eventually to Shechem, which of course is neither of the places to which God told him to go. Keep a finger there in chapter 33 and come back with me to Genesis and verse 31. Genesis 31 and verse 3. "Then the Lord said to Jacob, 'Go back to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you.'" In particular here, the command of the God of Israel, the command of the Lord, was for Jacob to return to Bethel. Now, I'm not a great artist, nor am I a good geography person, but let me just draw a little thing for you here. We've got the Jordan River looking something like that. We've got the Sea of Galilee up here. We've got the Dead Sea coming up down there. And we've got this this river, Jacob, coming out right about there. Now, the place where Jacob had his vision and wrestled with the Lord, Peniel, is right about there. Bethel is right about here. Shechem, Okay, now in order to get to Peniel, right? It's a you want to go that way, right? Which is southwest sort of direction. But Shechem ends up being, well, right there. Now, I'm not a great cartographer, but I know enough to know that this isn't this. And Seir, where he told his brother Esau that he would meet him, was right about there. He didn't obey God by going to Bethel, and he didn't stay true to his word to his brother by going to Seir. Instead, he went to Succoth and to Shechem. Succoth is an area over here on the east side of the Jordan. Jacob has been changed, but regretfully, Jacob has not yet been changed all that much. Would you come with me to the book of Matthew? Matthew chapter 5. I'm going to give you a verse which will help you to know with what kind of volume you can speak of yourself as a son or a daughter of God. This verse will determine whether you need to turn the volume down when you say you're a daughter or son of God, or whether you can turn the volume up so that others can hear you. Whether you need to whisper it in the shadows of a dark alley where very few will hear, or whether you can stand on a stage and shout it through the microphone through thousands, this verse will indicate to you just how much you should turn the volume up on the statement, I'm a son or a daughter of the living God. Matthew chapter 5 and verse 43. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemies. See the first word of verse 44? But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. He causes the sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your brothers, what are you doing more than others? Do not even the pagans do that? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. Christians are called to the higher ethic of loving and praying for their enemies. Loving and praying those who have been a scoundrel to them. Loving and praying those who have cheated. Praying and loving for those who have stolen their birthright and their blessing. Christians are called to the higher ethic of loving the offender. And remember that language about how Esau responded, running to Jacob, throwing his arms around him, kissing him on the cheek. Come with me to Luke chapter 15. You've heard this language if you're a reader of the New Testament before. And it's the language which Luke turns to and which Jesus uses as he tells us the parable of the prodigal son. Chapter 15 of Luke in verse 20. Remember, the son has offended his father, used up all of his father's money, he's been found in the pigsty. He comes crawling back to his dad. At least he'll be able to get a meal. Notice verse 20 as to how his dad, who has been offended, the father who has been misused by his son. Verse 20. So he got up and went to his father, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. And he ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. You see, the way that Esau related to his brother who had offended him is the exact same way the father responded when you came to him in faith in his son. You had offended him far more than anybody had ever offended you. You had abused his grace. You had abused his generosity. You had gone your own way and done your own things. And yet, when you came to the father through faith in his son, the father ran to you, the offender, threw his arms around your neck, the neck of the offender, kissed you, the face of the offender. What will you do the next time you see your offender? I pray by the Holy Spirit that He will strengthen you to love your enemy, to pray for your enemy. Because He is the God who causes the sun to shine on the just and the unjust and causes the rain to fall upon both the righteous and the unrighteous. And you are held to the higher Christian ethic of love for your enemy. Love for the spouse, love for the child, love for your employer, love for your employee, love for the person on I-75, love for your politician, love for whoever you can imagine, you're called to love and to pray for the offender. So what's the language of your feet going to be? Get your running shoes on. Put your running shorts on. Get your t-shirt on. Lace up good and tight because you all have some running to do. So get running. Father, I pray through the Spirit and by the name of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, that you would strengthen us by the Spirit who indwells us to love our enemies, to pray for those who persecute us, to forgive those who have offended us. Would you find us all good athletes in the competition of running to embrace, to love, to kiss those that have offended us. I ask it in the name of Jesus and by the Spirit of God. Amen.